No, Your Honor, because it's a statutory section that specifically allows that, and that is a different matter, I would submit, Your Honor, than asking a defendant about 404B testimony in detail. Remember, you get to write, if I'm a defendant and I take the witness stand, yes, you can ask me about my prior felony convictions or some general questions about what the nature of the conviction was. You don't get to go into detail about the facts of that conviction. In this case, the prosecutor was allowed to ask detailed questions about his interactions with each of these 404B witnesses. That goes way beyond anything you're allowed to ask. Well,
each of whom had already
prior felony conviction.
Each of whom had already testified.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why is that not, as Judge Navarro suggested, why is that not questioning that goes to his credibility, which is allowed by Rule 611?
Because, Your Honor, just because these witnesses testified, it doesn't mean that Mr. Niger himself opened the door. The language in Skufka says, among the following, the trial court held that Skufka could be questioned about the evidence during cross-examination only to the extent it opened the door during the direct examination.
Which came up because of the Curtis advisement and the balancing of his Fifth Amendment right to testify. But that wasn't, none of that was presented to the trial judge here. And in fact, do you even contend that this is a constitutional issue or just a rules of evidence?
I think, Your Honor, I think it's constitutional error.
You don't argue that in your brief, do you?
To some degree we do. But by citing Skufka's language, which states clearly that in Skufka, the cross-examination, the issue of the scope of cross-examination clearly went to Mr. Dodger's right to take a stand in his own defense, but his right not to open the door to self-incrimination on any other matters.
Was there any suggestion in the record here by his defense counsel that allowing these questions infringes his constitutional right either to testify or to not testify?
I don't think that was brought up in the trial court, but trial counsel did state at the close of the prosecutor's cross-examination, when the prosecutor again requested the right to cross-examine Mr. Niger about the 404B testimony, he did state that he thought that ruling was vital to the entire case and affected the entire case. Now, he didn't use the words constitutional error, but I don't think that matters, Judge. The reality is this was a preserved issue. It was preserved by the defense at various times. So it is a preserved issue. Mm-hmm. And the Skufka decision was clearly been decided years before this case. And therefore, whether Skufka was actually brought up or the word constitutional error was used, the law was clear, in my opinion, about whether Mr. Niger could be cross-examined in this way and going way beyond anything that Mr. Niger had opened the door to. I don't, you know, the argument is made that we have to have effective cross-examination, and we have to allow prosecutors the right to effectively cross-examine. It can't simply be a recitation of what somebody testified to on direct. And I agree with that, and that's the Salas case. But this is not an issue like in Salas, where if Mr. Niger simply got on the witness stand and said, one question, did you ever inappropriately touch the victim? No. Would then the prosecution not be allowed to ask, well, did you ever touch the victim? Did you ever make certain comments to the victim? Did you ever offer the victim any money in return for sex? Of course the prosecution would have allowed to ask all those questions. Whether or not that stuff had been directly asked of Mr. Niger on direct.
But this
goes way beyond that.
Mr. Frum, assuming for the moment, for the purposes of argument, that we disagree with you and that under 611, the prosecution could cross-examine the defendant on matters affecting his credibility. Is that what happened? Did this 404B evidence affect his credibility?
Well, clearly the prosecutor thought it did because he...
But I'm asking your opinion.
Well, of course it affects his credibility.
So if we disagree with you on the scope of the rule, then you lose.
Well, if you're going to look solely at the scope of the rule, understanding that the rule is a general rule that applies to civil and criminal cases, it does not discuss specifically criminal defendants, and you're going to just decide that Skufka doesn't apply and the language in Skufka doesn't apply, then I guess the answer is yes. I mean, I can't answer it any other way, but Rule 611 is a general rule that applies to civil cases, applies to criminal cases for all witnesses. Skufka relates directly to criminal defendants and the scope of their, and the scope of the cross-examination of a particular, of a criminal defendant, which I would submit is a very different issue than cross-examining a person in a civil case or a non-defendant.
Were you relying on the Salas case?
I am not relying on the Salas case.
Well, doesn't the Salas case say that a criminal defendant can be cross-examined in the same manner as any other testifying witness?
Yes, and I think there's general language that suggests that, but Salas came way before Stuckey, and the facts of Salas were totally different, Your Honor. Salas involved, you know, an issue about whether you could basically how much cross-examination of a victim you could ask of the defendant regarding the defendant's own interactions with the victim. And the trial court basically set up a system there which seemed very peculiar. It basically set up a mock cross-examination, which obviously gave the defendant, you know, a lot of heads up about what was going to be asked and how to prepare what his answers would be. But in that case, the court also pointed out that the trial court's letting some questions come in and some questions not be asked wasn't even internally consistent because the questions all related to the victim's and the defendant's relationship. Now, if Mr. Najjar had been asked simply questions about his relationship with the victim, whether Mr. Najjar had directly answered those questions or asked that specific question about a particular interaction, that would be Salas. But this isn't Salas. He wasn't asked questions about his relationship, no matter whether they were asked of him on direct or not. He was asked about questions about other persons who testified solely as 404B witnesses. And I think that is a major distinction, and I think that makes this case much closer to Stuckey than it does to Salas. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left.
All right, Mr. Furman, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Van Horn?
May I please support Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people. Stuckey did not hold that a prosecutor cannot cross-examine a defendant about matters that weren't covered on direct. What Stuckey said was, in this case, the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it admitted the evidence and then ruled that if Stuckey were to testify, the prosecutor could ask Stuckey questions that were covered on direct. So Stuckey was looking at the specific facts and claims before. It wasn't, it didn't issue a general holding that in no case can a prosecutor ask a defendant questions on cross that weren't covered during direct. And in this case, the cross-examination was relevant. It was relevant to his credibility, and therefore it was proper under 611.
So in Stuckey, when all the rulings about what the witness could be asked and not asked were made before the witness decided to testify, if I have the chronology right,
yes,
it doesn't necessarily matter. And he decided not to take the witness stand, so it's a little bit different.
Yes.
Here the witness took the witness stand without any preliminary rulings as to what the scope of the cross-examination might be. But before the cross-examination started, the prosecutor did make a motion and the judge said, no, don't go into the 404B material, as I understand.
Correct.
However, he had already testified on direct at that point in time, is that right? And what I'm trying to get at is, did he take the stand thinking that he had some protections on cross-examination as the witness in Stuckey, as the defendant in Stuckey would have had? I can't get that from the record here.
I don't believe so. Okay.
So he took the stand kind of just as any other witness would, without any kind of, apparently after Curtis advised him and knowing that he was subject to cross-examination.
Correct. And I think the language that defense counsel relies on in Stuckey is very specific to the facts and what the trial court had ruled in Stuckey. Because the trial court did rule in Stuckey, I'll only allow questions that were covered during direct. So when the Supreme Court is using this language about the trial court not abusing its discretion or not committing any error in its ruling, you have to look at it in that context, these statements about what was covered during direct and not covered during direct.
Could you explain to me how the 404B evidence affected his credibility and whether or not that inference or the theory of whether or not an effector's credibility is based on this propensity inference, because he did it with others, he did it again.
I do think it affected his credibility in that when he was testifying, he portrayed himself as the sort of person who would never say these kinds of things or commit these sorts of actions at work. And so I do think it affected his credibility. And I do think it was important to ask him about, well, when this person says, you say this, did you say this to her? And he just all the way down the line said, no, I think on one answer he said, I may have, but that was just something to the effect of, are you married? It wasn't one of the more egregious comments. And I don't think it was improper propensity evidence. It just showed the purposes for which it was admitted, lack of mistake, his knowledge. It just shows the way he operates with these women who work at a store. So I do think it was properly admitted.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions,
I have a question about the limiting instruction issue.
Yes.
So as I understand it, there was no additional limiting instruction given during cross-examination of the defendant about this 404B evidence.
Correct. Right?
And I noticed that there was already an earlier limiting instruction when the evidence was admitted during the earlier testimony.
Correct.
But what about the exhibits that were admitted? Weren't those admitted for the first time on cross-examination of the defendant? And isn't that new 404B evidence that would require a new limiting instruction?
It's my memory that the only exhibit that was admitted during cross was the videotape of him with RR, one of the 404B witnesses.
There was exhibits 567, according to the defendant's brief.
And I don't know what those are. In my reading of the record, I was looking at, well, what 404B evidence was admitted during his testimony? Well, he denied committing all the acts. So the prosecutor's questions in themselves, of course, that was not 404B evidence. He denies committing all the acts. I recall that they showed the videotape and asked him, in this videotape, what are you doing here? And that videotape had been previously admitted when RR testified with a limiting instruction. And he denied that he was doing anything inappropriate. And it's difficult to tell from the tape where if he's actually touching this woman or whether his hands are just in front of her.
So according to the defendant's brief, just to make sure on the same page, Exhibit 5 was a still photo of defendant with one of the other women at the cash register. And that was admitted for the first time during cross-examination of the defense.
I don't recall that, but assuming that that's correct and the first time that evidence came in was during his cross-examination, I don't think there was any error since those witnesses testified as to the events that occurred in the convenience store. The jury received limiting instructions then, when what they were talking about came in, which is, I'm sure, what was depicted in the stills, that it wasn't anything different from what had been testified to by the 404B witnesses. And I think given the fact that we had multiple limiting instructions and a final limiting instruction, and that we'd be looking at this under a plain error standard, there is no reversible error when it comes to the limiting instruction issue.
Well, on the final limiting instruction did not mention, as far as I understand, the specific purpose for which the evidence was admitted. Isn't that an error under the statute?
Correct. Under the statute, you're supposed to put the specific purposes for which the evidence was admitted. Here, however, the court's contemporaneous instructions contained that language, and the final written limiting instruction referred back to those contemporaneous instructions, and therefore, looking at the instructions as a whole, there was no error.
Are you saying no error, no plain error?
No reversible,
okay.
No plain error. Yes. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Van Norm. Mr. Perman?
There were, in fact, three photographs admitted on cross-examination of Mr. Nigel that were not admitted into evidence prior to that cross-examination. One of those photographs, the prosecution contended, showed Mr. Nigel kissing one of the 404B witnesses. That was clearly 404B evidence, even if nothing else was 404B evidence, there was no limiting instruction given at the time, which the court has an independent duty to do under the statute. And there was no reference in the closing instructions to those exhibits being introduced. And in fact, I would argue, if you're a juror and you're told when specific people testify that you can only consider that evidence for a limited purpose, but aren't told that when exhibits are admitted to evidence, that you might come to exactly a different conclusion, that you can make of those whatever you desire. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Perman. Thank you again, Ms. Van Horn. Your arguments were excellent, and I think they were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.